Okay.
Ist deine Docker-Show.
Off we go.
Okay.
Yeah, English or German?
English, we will address the whole world. In German, address Saxonia. No one wants this. No, I have to apologize, actually. The only people who are listening are in Saxonia. And these are the two exceptional good guys.
Yeah.
And then everything else is wrong.
But I hope that we have more than two listeners, actually. I mean, it's the fifth show. I think it's like a Broadway show, so it's more show than...
That's half of a decade of shows.
Yeah. It's semi-decimal. No, anyway. Yeah, okay. So today we want to talk about, or I want to talk about, I mean, you just listen since last time I listened.
You want to... last show was more or less my show because I was talking all the time about buzzwords, and now it's Christian's turn and he can get to talk about
Docker. Yeah, about the cool stuff. No, about Docker.
And once in a while, I will jump in and have a question. Actually, last night, while I was thinking about the show, I had already some questions, but I forgot to write them down. So
you forgot the questions then?
That's more complicated. But I can start if you want. No, you make a decent introduction now to Docker.
Yeah, actually, the reason why why this topic pops up is that next week I'm off. Off to Frankfurt, so I'm not in Berlin for a couple of days. There's a conference about HPC stuff. So the conference where I went the last 5 years, 6 years, basically. And last year I had a workshop about Docker, and this year I have the same workshop with different people, but still for our workshop. And I prepared some slides yesterday, and I want to check them out and reply them or convey them to Hagen, and then let's see what comes out of this test of my slides. But thing is that the agenda does not include me talking about Docker in general. So the parts I'm talking about, it's like I make a quick introduction, but the introduction makes no sense in radio, I think. So introduction of the workshop. And then my dear friend Holger will talk about Linux containers in a nutshell. This would be the introduction, but I think this introduction I should stage for you then, right? To introduce Docker in general.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I have some other things. I will just hop in, I think. I have an old... Yeah, here we go. Yeah, so what is Docker? Hagen, what is Docker? Where do we want me to start? Should I start in the beginning, back in the days? Should I start with containers? Maybe we talk about what is virtualization.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
I mean, if you go back decades, you only had one process, one user, and then you opened up the system to multi-process, multi-user. That was kind of a resource sharing. That was kind of a first virtualization, you can say, right?
So if I would have like my mainframe and I have my user login, and then I get one shell for me.
Yeah, back
when and the I first... share the time on the mainframe.
Exactly. And for you, it was exclusive. So only one user, one process could run a process on this machine. And then they open it up by doing time sharing.
I ask my professor, user, can I use the mainframe? And he go, yes, between 2 and 3 in the night, because all the other time is reservation to me.
Exactly. And once you introduce the multi-user and multi-process, you could share the resources. So that was not virtualization in the sense of we know about it. It's like more resource sharing. And then fast forward.
Oh, no, it was the first attempt for the sharing economy.
Yeah, man. Yeah, that's my, yeah, one could say that, but no. Anyway, and I mean, this is where the kernel and the operating system came in, right? They tried to make an operating system that is multi-process and multi-user, which we have still nowadays, where we might, but this is looking in the glass bowl. We might go back to this one process, one user thing. But yeah, not start with the with the end at the beginning. Anyway, so this was the first noticeable resource sharing virtualization thingy, and the real virtualization where everyone thinks about is, at least, or everyone our age thinks about virtualization, is with virtual machines. Where, and this you had in mainframes as well, where you can, I think it's way too in the past.
One sentence.
Yeah, you there were hardware virtualization also in like the Linux main or the mainframes from IBM, so that you had real hardware separation. So you had virtual machines, but there were now the hypervisor was a hardware hypervisor, right? So the hypervisor is the thing that isolates one machine from one virtual machine from the other on top of nowadays a normal machine. So you have a physical machine, then you have your hypervisor. The hypervisor translates what the virtual machine wants to do with the hardware to the real hardware. And so you have like multiple virtual machines that are running parallel to each other and sharing the same hardware underneath, but they don't know about each other. So they say, okay, I run Windows, I run...
And that's a good thing.
Linux. That's a good thing because, that introduced ways of, or the means of having more effective IT operations, right? Because you could have one beefy server and then you could have multiple applications or multiple operating systems, multiple virtual machines running on those, on this hardware, totally separated from each other. So when one machine went bad, it didn't potentially affect the other machine.
Good. That's a good thing.
That's a good thing. Problem was that once you have this virtual machine, it has to talk to the network and it has to talk to disks and so on, right? So since the hypervisor translates from the virtual machine to the hardware, this has a very big performance penalty involved, right? So if the virtual machines, as I said, does not know about other virtual machines in the traditional sense. So when back in the days where virtual machines were just beginning. So when it wants to write to the network, for instance, it thought that it has power over the complete network resource, and then it was just pushing data to the network interface of the hypervisor, and then the hypervisor said, yeah, okay, I have to multiplex this, or I have to multiplex this with the other network traffic from the other virtual machine. And the kernel underneath on the hypervisor kernel, or the kernel that the hypervisor was talking to, was very busy scheduling all this traffic and has to say, okay, you got a share, and then you got a share, and then you get a share. So that was a big performance hit in terms of network and in terms of data for starters, but also for scheduling the processes as well. So if the process in the virtual machine wanted to issue a syscall that involved exclusive usage of the CPU, then the hypervisor and the kernel underneath, they had to deal with blocking the CPU for this, or the core for this virtual machine, and others were not able to perform this operations on the CPU while operations were performed from the other virtual machine. So bottom line is that within the virtual machine, the process or the application didn't know, or the whole operating system didn't know about the other. So it was like a drunken guy in a bar, just like smashing and saying, yeah, I'm the king of the world, so don't go in my way. And we're thinking he has exclusive rights to everything. And underneath, the kernel was very busy with the hypervisor to schedule all the things. This was partly resolved by introducing paravirtualization, so that you had resources that were brought exclusively to the where the virtual machine was aware of the virtualness of itself. So it got a network interface that had drivers that were prepared for this virtual machine interaction. So before, the driver within the operating system of the virtual machine was just saying, okay, you have a generic network interface. And when they introduced a special driver, the special drivers for power virtualization, the driver was tailored and was telling the operating system, okay, you can directly reach the underlying hardware or more directly reach the underlying hardware without going through this generic driver where you do not know that it's a virtual machine and so on. And this was speeding up the thing very much because, the access was more direct and the distance, so to speak, from the real hardware was not so much anymore. So this sped up the performance quite a bit, but it was still a penalty in terms of performance, because you had still this layer underneath. Yeah, and I think one drawback of this whole virtual machine thing was, or is still, that you have to define how much resources. So if you have like a 24 core machine and you put virtual hypervisor on it and virtual machines, you define when you start the virtual machine how many CPU cores should this thing have and how many memory and so on. So you constrain the resource consumption of each virtual machine because you define how much resources the virtual machine gets. So you chunk up your hardware or your resources into little pieces and then give it to a virtual machine. I mean, you can over provision. So if you have like 24 cores, you can say this machine has 24 cores, or this virtual machine has 24 cores, and the other one has as well 24 cores. So you over provision your resources. But that's not really nice to do. And in modern hypervisors, you can even swap out CPUs, so you can change the number of CPUs while the system is running. But I think no one is really using it much because it's the software has to comply with it, and this is not really used. Okay, so we covered virtual machines now, and the good thing about virtual machines in an operational sense, but I will touch on this later as well, but just briefly, is that it very much fits into the model of physical machines beforehand in an operational sense. So you have MAC addresses, if you like, you have different IP addresses, if you like. It looks like a machine to you, hence the name, virtual machine. It looks the same as a physical machine. It's just more fluent or more flexible. You can start a virtual machine without deploying a physical machine, so it's much faster, but the paper trail could be the same. So if you need an IP address in your organization, it's the same process, except maybe you have a checkbox at the top of the sheet where you have to state whether it's a physical or a virtual machine. But in terms of operations of this thing, it looks quite the same and it works the same. So there was no disruption in the operations due to virtual machines.
And everything was as complicated as before with provisioning everything in terms of from the developer perspective. You would still go and ask, does this machine has this feature, that feature? You were not in charge of it. You still had to go somewhere to ask the responsible person for provisioning boxes. Is this my machine? Like, I want to have this and this and that. And then they would go and leave for 2 months and then come back to you and say, now I have the virtual machine for you.
Yeah.
That's exactly what you not wanted.
Yeah, I mean, in the beginning, that was the case. But the more the tools that brought up the virtual machines were like API, had APIs and were more programmable, like OpenStack and OpenNebula and all this, that was more, that became easier for a developer, so that you have a self-service kind of thing.
I never got into that luxury of working with these. I always had like either an organization bought like a huge machine and then put everything on top of that, and then you would always go to an operational person and ask for a share, and then he would go, why do you want a storage cluster? Because the client wants it. Yeah, I have no space.
Yeah, sure. I mean, in the beginning, when you have the VMware, ESX clusters or whatnot, then there were, as you said, there were one guy responsible for it, and he had to create the virtual machines. And then you say, okay, I want this image on this virtual machine, and then you give me access, and off you go. So you have to click, and it was more, it was not totally automated. But that was, I think, also from, it stems from the way physical machines were operated, and operations were not able or capable or willing to give up their paper trail or their normal operations way of operating the things. So there were still the guy clicking and pushing, and it was not handed over to the customer or the internal customer, even, because that was not thought of. That was not the idea.
Yeah.
I think. I mean, I learned in a university back in the days, and we had an ESX cluster. After a couple of years, they bought an ESX cluster, and my boss, friend of mine, said that he had like three ESX, beefy ESX machines, and there were four or five virtual machines running. And in the library, they had a license server on a workstation running. And I said, yeah, why don't you virtualize this license server? It's on a workstation, and it's a license server. It should be like, it's the ideal case for your cluster. And said, yeah, but you know, if you have stuff like that on it, then it's like important, and you cannot tear it down as you like, and this is your responsibility. I mean, and then this, so it was still the case that it was not utilized because they don't want to have this, well, he didn't want to have the responsibility for all the stuff that's running on it. So it was his machine and only running his stuff. And it was not that anyone can go and say, okay, I want a share of your virtual machine cluster and run stuff on it. It was more, I mean, that's more where I think we come from. If you have a big machine, then you want to use it.
Right? And it should burn.
It should burn, yeah. Even if it's doing useless indexing of def zero.
Indexing with Lucene is never useless. Never. It's always like, it's like fireworks.
Yeah.
I mean, computer, not Lucene, computers. It's like, yeah, it can be like, it's amazing. Just to a short remark off topic, if somebody listens to the construction works in the background, yes, we have construction works going on, and maybe it's on the tape.
Yeah, I think I hear it on the post.
It's definitely hearable on the pre.
It's a bit hearable here, I think.
So very like highly skilled people flexing down the roof or something. I don't know. Since weeks now. No, not weeks.
Yeah, but they will. It will be
just
perfect
just
afterwards.
In case. I just want to mention it. Let nobody wonder. It's like in my brain there is something. It's from the tape. We produce it here.
Okay, but still, yeah. So that was the starting of the virtual machine stuff, and this became more and more programmable, so to speak, with OpenStack and more and more self-service. I think that's also one key in this whole story, that once it was self-service, so that you as a developer could say, okay, I need a machine, and then you click, and then you got the virtual machine provisioned, and it came back to you, and then you could do stuff, and then you could destroy it. That was a very, very important step in this whole virtual machine story, I think. Because first, before, when you had a virtual machine and it was a hassle to get those virtual machines, then you wouldn't let off of this virtual machine, right? So I heard a talk once where one guy from the NASA, and they are behind the OpenStack thingy. Was it OpenStack or was it OpenNebula? I think it was. Anyway, but it was like this pre-self-service thing, and he said, yeah, okay, I need a virtual machine. And as he knew that it was very complicated to get those, he said, yeah, I need a very big one. And how much storage do I need? I think 1 terabyte. And 1 terabyte really were a thing. Like, I need 1 terabyte because I need it. And then he stored only a couple of megabytes of his stuff on this big share because he thought, okay, haben ist besser als brauchen. having something is better than needing something. And then over a coffee or over a drink at another party, he asked his counterpart on the operations or the guy who was giving him the resources, he asked him, okay, what does it cost, by the way? And he said, yeah, oh, your storage costs $10,000 a month, and because 1 terabyte. And he was like, oopsie. Okay, or was it a year? It was expensive anyways, and he was not using it and utilizing it. And this is this is due to the fact that if it's hard to get, then you will over-provision yourself and you will not say, I just need this. And you will estimate what you might need, and then you will go for the high number instead of the normal number. And if it's unprovisioned, then you will, or when you finish your work, you might reuse the resources you have with something completely different, and this is also not optimal, right? So they came up with this scheduling provisioning mechanism. I think it's open. Is it OpenStack? No, it was not the predecessor of OpenStack. I will Google it quickly now that I talk too much bullshit. Yeah, it's from Rackspace and NASA. Yeah, but it was a predecessor. Anyway, so they started this OpenStack thing, and I mean, this was the
when roughly was it, like
2010?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, began in 2010, and it was a project that was sparked by Rackspace. So Rackspace is a big hosting company in the US, and the NASA. And it's not that old, actually, right? It's 6 years old.
Oh, and I remember that we, like in a former company, our one operations guy in 2011 or 12, because 11 I started and must be 11 or 12. So he was giving a talk about OpenStack, and he was buying into this that you serve your private cloud using OpenStack. You just buy a bunch of hardware and
the problem, I mean, OpenStack, maybe to just state what it is, it's like a GUI, and it's a system to provision virtual machine or virtual infrastructure nowadays in large. So you can have compute resources, you have storage, you have networking, so the software-defined networking, and you can create your infrastructure as a service, to use a buzzword. So you say, I would like to have 5 machines, I want them wired together with this network infrastructure, I want them using this and this block devices, and so on. So I want to have this credentials between them, and so on. So it's infrastructure as a service. Describes it, I think. You can you can spin up whatever infrastructure you need in this virtual environment. And it's not only, I think this started, I think, with Xen or with KVM, so that the virtual machines were spun up on KVM or Xen. And nowadays, I think you can spin it up with almost always a bunch of virtual, of hypervisors. So you can even use Hyper-V.
So KVM and what was the other one?
Xen,
these are like software hypervisors.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so Xen is one of the older, and KVM as well. Yeah, they have KVM, QEMU, and Xen, and a bunch of others. And yeah, they are just they are just in the middle, as I said before, in the middle of the hardware, between the hardware and the actual hardware and the virtual machines, and they. Mapping syscalls from all the different virtual machines on the host to the hardware, and doing all the negotiations in terms of resources. And they are also, since the hypervisor is not using syscalls directly, but this is, I think, going too far, it's hypercalls. It's a little bit, or it's not a little bit, it's much securer, and it's built from scratch to supply this virtual machine infrastructure. So And this is where we transition or first touch the container space, I think. Talking about this hypervisor, hypercall things. In containers Or maybe we should finish the OpenStack thing. But I think it was. Yeah, it's basically finished, I think. So let's just wrap up the OpenStack. So OpenStack, as I said, it's that infrastructure as a service. You can install it on a couple of machines, and then you can run multiple virtual machines in it. You have a GUI. You can click, I want to have this machine with this amount of resources, and then you get it. Thing is that it's hard to install because nowadays it has like 12 projects or more than a dozen projects internally. So your Horizon, for instance, is a GUI, and Nova is a hypervisor controller, and then you have the object store, and then you have the authentication agency, and then you have a lot of stuff inside of OpenStack that you need to install. And
I just fall asleep.
Yeah. I installed it 7.5 times, and
never got it to run.
Yeah, I got it to run once, I think, but I never touched it because it was I think too cumbersome.
Shaky, shaky, shaky.
Boom. Yeah, it's too cumbersome. I don't like stuff that's cumbersome to install. We have 2016.
You're so unpassionate.
Yeah, no, I'm passionate about things that works and it's easy for the user to use, and I think OpenStack is more complex, and once it runs then it's easy for everyone for the users to use, but yeah, it's a big chunk. There's another tool, OpenNebula, which is API compliant to AWS. Oh, and now we go to let's iterate. OpenStack is on premise, and once this was like this became shapes in terms of it was usable, I think AWS or Amazon used its own virtual infrastructure as a service internally, and then they thought, okay, we have such a huge infrastructure to supply our services, why not make a product out of it? And then they came up with AWS EC2, which is infrastructure as a service from the cloud, so to make it buzzwordy. So before they had this infrastructure internally, and then they said, okay, let's allow people to just swipe their credit card and get virtual machines and virtual networking and all that in our infrastructure. And this began, what do you think? What is your guess? When did EC2 start?
2006? Or even earlier.
You think? But then that breaks what I just said. 2006.
Yeah. You're a terrible liar.
I'm a terrible liar.
Elastic.
Yeah, it's 2006.
Computing cloud. Yeah, I remember this because when I was having my startup and when I was all hipster and millennial, we did a quick research on that, and I tried to make billions of money out of AIM messages.
AMI, yeah.
AMI machines. Images. Yeah. It's a bit older, yeah.
Yeah, right. So OpenStack was then a reaction on AWS, maybe. Yeah, you see, we are a professional podcast.
Don't be like, that's normal. Like, so first it was the, you were using Amazon Web Services. That was the first thing. Like in studies, when in my like pre-studies, 2002, 2003, I had to work and bring up a web service, like write an application. The task was write an application that incorporates a web service from the internet. And it must be like SOAP and WSDL and UDDI, which was these awful web service infrastructure before JSON and REST and JSON-based REST services. And so I was going to the Amazon Web Services. And that was, you can go get prices, get trades, get blah, 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 all kinds of stuff from the Amazon platform. And then on top of that, they decided that they could work on their web services to allow a web service that allows you to get virtual machines, and then the open compute, like the Elastic Computing Cloud, was born.
Yeah, I see. I used to work in this HPC community, which is, it was never a thing. The web services was never a thing, and OpenStack was long time not a thing for our stuff because it was, you had this penalty. So
I
virtual
understand
machines,
it's just completely different. Like you would have your PHP web store launched on an AMI on EC2, and that was very like edgy.
But the AMI was provided by Amazon.
Yeah. Yeah.
So and once they opened up the AMI stuff, that was open compute then. So you can create your own AMI.
Yeah. And I remember like you looked at prices of AMIs. So you would pay for an AMI that is like, you could get Typo3 like from standard, cost you nothing. But then you would get like the awesome stuff with like a template in it for more than nothing, like some bucks.
Okay.
So you could trade, like you could be the smart guy who was building up AMI images.
Okay. Yeah, you see. So that was in the cloud.
Why don't we sell Docker containers, by the way?
I think the...
We would be millionaires.
Yeah, but I think we are too late for this as well. It's always the same. We have the good ideas too late.
Well, so let's go now to the exciting stuff. Virtual
no.
machines
okay.
are lame and boring and hard to manage, and they use a lot of unnecessary resources, and they open up a massive security surface attack because they launch a whole operating system, and they are hard to introduce into IntelliJ, and I don't like them, and I want to use Docker. Does it make your way free?
That frees up the street or the segue to Docker. So I will repeat it once more. So traditional virtualization, we have the complete system of the hardware. So we have the hardware, we have the operating system on top of it, then we have the hypervisor to provide the means to start virtual machines, and the virtual machines are basically just mimic what a physical machine would do, and when you start a virtual machine, then the BIOS, there's even a BIOS within virtual machines nowadays, you can skip this, but back in the days, there's a BIOS, then the BIOS start the kernel, and so on and so on, so you have the complete machine within this virtual machine, and on top of this, you can run your desired service. But as we are cool, we just want to run thin services, and we want to run a lot of them. So that's kind of a mess because you have to provision a lot of virtual machines to run this cool microservice infrastructure. So that's never lifted off, for me at least, for us, I think, or for us in the cool pond. And when I started with Docker like 3 years ago or so, and my task was, or my self-set task was to create a data center on my laptop, and I wanted to create a lot of virtual machines with a lot of the pieces that you need for a data center, so main server, DNS server, DHCP server, all this, and monitoring and logging and all that, and you need a lot of machines. So I started with VirtualBox, and I started 5 machines, and then my laptop was too busy to do anything else, so I said, with virtual machines will never get me there. And then I put this project aside for half a year or so, and then in 2013, end of 2013, I stumbled upon Docker, and I said, okay, that looks nice. So you could have little containers. I didn't exactly understood containers back then, but I thought, okay, that looks like a more efficient approach to have multiple virtual thingies, not virtual machines, but virtual containers, and have these little pieces chunk up in little containers and then run it. So containers are, or Linux containers are, operating system virtualization. So what does it mean? You have one kernel on the hardware. So as you have with a normal operating system, then you have your user land, so all the libraries, all the files, file systems on top of this. So that's your operating system as you know it. And instead of an hypervisor, you just have a controller, a Docker daemon, but you don't need it for the sake of this explanation. So you have the host kernel and the user land, and on top of that you can just spawn a different user land, a distinct user land from your own, and which will communicate like you do with your host kernel. And the host kernel will make sure that this this user land has a isolated view of the resources. So how are resources organized in the host kernel? You have a lot of namespaces. You have 5 namespaces. So you have,
which are?
You have a process tree, that's also a PID namespace. So if you do PS minus EF on your operating system, you see numbers and numbers of the process or process ID, and then you see the parent of this process ID. So that's a tree, right? So you start your operating, or when the system comes up, the init system will get PID 1, and then from there on it's all a tree. And when you start a container, this container will get his own PID namespace, meaning that within the container you type PS minus EF and you only see the 2 processes or the processes of your container. That's like hidden from the outside world, is hidden from you by having your own namespace. The underlying system itself sees all your processes, and you are part of the process tree of the host system. So you have like the PID 10,000, for instance, in the host, but within your container you are isolated. It's like a child. So like, yeah, and the world is not complicated. You only know your father and your mother, and the rest is like hidden from you. The rest is like people. Maybe don't even, they hide you somewhere. Maybe no, that's too much, but
hey.
So you
off
don't
the rails again.
You don't see anything else. So that's the PID namespace. Then you have the mount namespace, so that you can only see file systems that are really mounted to your container. The rest is also hidden. So you have your root file system in the basic case, where you have your own file system that is mounted to your root of your container, and then you not rely on anything that is.
Yeah. So I'm now jumping a bit ahead, but if in my Docker file I don't specify a volume anything, then I don't have like a mount namespace.
No, you get a mount namespace anyway, but you could have an empty file system. You could have only.
How much space does it then have?
0. Yeah, you need one process because you have to start a process. So you need one binary that you can execute. Let's say you create a little C or whatever bytecode application that just sleeps, that just waits. So like it's very tiny, like 4 lines in C, I think. Or a Go, can do it in Go as well. A static compiled binary that only needs itself, doesn't even need libc. Then you can put this little binary into your empty file system. And this is a very the simplest container you can get. Then you run the container. The container only has one file in its tree. It's like slash binary. And you execute this slash binary as a command within your container. Then you have the PID 1 given to this binary or this process binary. And then the rest is empty. So the name, the mount namespace or the file system within the container is totally distinct. Which is cool because you could have multiple, or you could have different user lands, so a different operating system basically, within different containers. It has to be Linux because it's Linux container, so you need the Linux kernel, but you could have Fedora alongside with CentOS, alongside with Ubuntu, alongside with Gentoo even, alongside with Arch Linux, whatever. So you can have all the Linux distributions alongside each other because they can talk to the same kernel. And the kernel is such a commodity nowadays that this is the case. So
so Red Hat, every Linux distribution shares like some standard kernel, and that's why you can run all of them.
Yeah, the thing is that the kernel is very, very stable in terms of backwards compatibility. In the normal CentOS 6, for instance, uses kernel 2.6.32, which is backports from a lot of more recent kernels, but still it uses a kind of old version of the kernel. But the kernel, even if you run a four something kernel, it's very backwards compatible in a way that even if there is a bug in the kernel, used to be a bug in the kernel, and programmers or system programmers, they relied on this bug to be there. The newer kernels, they will detect that this code needs this bug, and then he will execute a code pass with the bug just to make sure that he breaks.
What?
He does not break anything. So if, let's say we assume you can introduce bugs in your code because normally it's like
what?
Yeah, normally
it's a developer. I never do errors. Yeah. The users do the errors.
Yeah, but imagine the user introduce a bug in your
I'm
software.
Done. I'm done. That's too much truth for me.
And you detect a bug in the software that an operations guy wrote.
That's always the case. They try to fix code and then they have no idea what they are doing,
you need to move on. So you deal with the bug by saying, okay, I know that there's
if check in from ops person X git blame revert.
Yeah, but you deal with you need to work around it. So you create a workaround and you rely on this bug. You rely then on this bug, right? If it's removed, you have to change your code. Then within the kernel, there are pieces where they detect that you need this bug, and then they will execute the buggy version just for the sake of backwards compatibility. So it's very.
And you wonder why certain people we are like in fight with nowadays. This is so wrong.
Yeah,
in so many ways, this is so wrong.
But anyway, let's not.
Oh God.
Yeah.
There would never have been like we should forbidden all other languages than Lisp.
Yeah, maybe. Okay, this is a mount named base. I try to make it nice.
Make it back.
Bring it back. Okay, so mount namespace, file system, and all that. And then you have the network namespace, which means you have your own distinct loopback device and IP address. So it's like network namespace as you expected. IPC namespace means that you cannot communicate with different processes, as inter-process communication. You cannot communicate from one container to the others using inter-process communication. And the UTS namespace is giving you a host name and a domain name. And then we have user namespace nowadays, where you can map different UIDs or say, okay, I execute my application within the container as root, but outside of the container, if I write something, then it's mapped to a different user ID. So everything written is maybe my own user, or if I issue a syscall, then I have no root privileges, but I have only reduced privileges. Yeah, this is 5+1, so the user namespace is pretty recent, or not pretty, but half a year old or so. So this kernel namespaces, they they isolate the different containers. So process containers are therefore just process groups, right? A container. You spawn a container by one process, and the kernel or the process to fork it to start this process. Just says, okay, I want to start this process in a different kernel namespace or different kernel namespaces than the host system. And then you have a container. And this process can itself spawn other or fork other processes. And then you have a group of processes that are just a container, a group of processes that are in certain different kernel namespaces. This is basically a container. And all the containers talk to the same host kernel. Hence, the kernel knows about everything, which is cool in regards to if we contrast this with virtual machines. In a virtual machine, if you have a two-socket machine with 24 cores in total, and two times 12 cores, and you give it to one virtual machine, one big virtual machine, the virtual machine will see one CPU with 24 cores. So it doesn't know about the two-socket setup configuration underneath. So the kernel within the host, within the virtual machine, will make decisions in terms of distributing processes and memory and so on, which are not really reflecting the physical setup. And then the underlying kernel under the hypervisor will also schedule the processes that are handed over, or handed down to from the hypervisor to the host kernel itself, and he has to make decisions as well. So you have two different kernels making scheduling decisions and resource decisions that are not really optimal, right? In the container, that goes back to making sense again, in my opinion, because you have a lot of containers. All of the containers are basically just groups of processes, and the kernel knows about each group of processes and each process, and he knows the amount of resources that the process is consuming, and then he can schedule the different process groups differently. And he can, but he knows all about the processes, and the processes itself, they talk to the same host kernel, so they know about the constraints and the setup of the virtual of the underlying hardware as well.
Can a Docker container be, or can a container in that sense be nice to the kernel and use the nice flag?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you can, a kernel, you have a lot of different, or you have a lot of scheduling decisions in the kernel. One is who gets which share of the CPU. So you have this CPU scheduling things, and you have a lot of a bunch of different strategies to do this, but maybe you say, okay, you have a weight for each process, and the weight says maybe by default one to everyone, and then everyone got the same amount of CPU shares for each process. And within containers or within these process groups, you can say, okay, but I want this container to have more shares than the others, and then this container will get more CPU resources, and this applies not only to CPUs but also to disk net IO. And this is C groups. So this is resource restrictions that you can apply to a certain process group and container. You can say this container is only allowed to write 1 megabyte per second to the disk, and then this container will only write 1 megabit per second to the disk. So you can constrain this process group.
Okay, and who in like which kind of instance will check for these constraints?
The kernel.
The kernel said there is no hypervisor involved.
No,
that goes like in comparison with the hypervisor who you are trying to use the network or you too or blah blah blah. I need to do something here, blah 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 blah. This is now kernel work.
Yeah, the kernel, all this namespace, or the kernel decides the shares of the resources, right? And for this he has a lot of counters. So like how many CPU shares has this thing given and how many cycles has it used and so on. And with this information, he can also constrain things. He could say, okay, this container is only allowed or has used so much resources. He will wait for a couple of cycles more than the others. So he can schedule the containers and make sure that the resource usage is equal or is applied that was stated by the user that started the container. So if you start a container and say, okay, this container is only able to use the first two cores of the CPU, then the kernel can make sure that this is the case, because he won't schedule the processes to different cores than the two that you stated the kernel the container should use. Mm-hmm. And this is true for all the C groups. So there are a couple of C groups, but I don't want to touch too much of them. Where do I have it? Where? We don't have to go to the C group. But anyway, you can, as I said, almost the namespaces that we have, they mostly come with also with this constraint thing, this was C group. So you can say you can constrain it on this, you can constrain it on net IO and so on, and you can constrain it on CPU shares, and that's kind of neat. So what was also neat is, and this is also in contrast to virtual machines, as I said before, virtual machines, you have to provision them with a certain resource definition. So you say, okay, this guy has two CPUs and the other guy has also two CPUs, and underlying hardware maybe has 8 CPUs. So you have to make decisions on how you provision the resources beforehand. In containers, if you do not restrict through C groups, a container can always use all resources of the host system. So if you start a container on a node then he can run a stress test and stress a complete system. And this you can constrain by C groups. You can get the shares, so you can make them different weights. So if you have a very resource intensive application, a potentially resource intensive application, like let's say Elasticsearch, for instance, you can give it a low priority, and if it tries to saturate all the CPUs, if there is another container that has a higher priority, he will get more CPU shares. But if there is no one else, then the Elasticsearch container can still use all the resources. But you can constrain him and say, okay, no, you are not that high in a priority because we know that you don't. I don't say that you do not, but
that you that's don't not care.
That's not important maybe for us now. So if we have the means of,
I would wonder how like Elasticsearch would behave in such a case, because I did some load testing recently and tried to like hammer it, and because like there are queues filling up, like if we cannot, like if we don't, like mostly Lucene is faster than the disk obviously, and also faster than SSDs. And we try to use multiple threads on SSDs to pump as much data, but then if it goes as fast as it can, it will block also, like it will use threads for indexing and for queuing up stuff that searches might get slowed down. So it has a built-in mechanism called index throttling. So it would by its own try to go and say, now I throttle indexing because otherwise my searches would get too slow. But if we go and say, yeah, you get less and less CPU because like on our shared system, other processes use more CPUs and have a higher priority. I wonder if Elasticsearch would just slow down or say, well, my queue sizes like ran out of memory in the indexing case, like the queue will fill up the memory at least if it's unbounded. And at some point it will get ran out of memory and will die.
Yeah, that's an interesting, I mean, that's...
So you yeah, but we should try this with the big cluster we have.
Yeah, no, but the thing is that C groups, if your application could be C groups aware, so if you constrain the process on two CPUs only, the Elasticsearch will see, oh, I have 24 cores, cool, but if it didn't know that it is only pinned to this two CPUs and it cannot use other CPUs, then it can start 12 of 24 threads, assuming that since the threads are busy, every thread will be busy, the kernel will just spread them across the 24 cores. But in fact, since it's constrained to only the first two cores, then this complete thread pool will be put on this two cores. And if Elasticsearch or the process didn't know about it, then it's kind of not
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, so, and you actually can, like, I read about that, and they say this, that they have this issue also with other hypervisors. So in the documentation of Elasticsearch, they actually say, normally, don't fiddle around with the thread pools, but if you're in the case of virtualization, you make sure that the number we get from the operating system by asking Java system call, give me my cores, if this number isn't correct, then you want to set the thread pools. But that's the only case.
Yeah, exactly. And but I think, but I'm not a C programmer or system.
Why not?
Yeah. I won't comment on that.
You're a Go programmer. What's the problem? You're already like,
but
you're already
same,
fine with that.
The same goes for top, for instance. If you create a container, start a container, and then you run top inside of the container, and your container is not doing anything, you will see the resource consumption of the host, of the complete host kernel, because you're talking to the host kernel. So if there is a container or another process on the host that uses 8 or half of the cores, then your top within your container that's doing nothing will show all the resource consumption of the host, right? So it would be nicer if the resource consumption of the container is only reflected in this output, right? If you don't do anything in the container, then it should show only this. But this is, since you talk to the kernel, and you are not asking only the counters of your own containers, you don't see this. You see the complete picture of the complete host. But if you know about it, then it's not a big deal. But yeah, you should be aware. Okay, so this is kernel namespaces and C groups, and the cool thing about and the nice thing about containers, and this is where virtual machine analogy breaks, is when you share namespace. So you can start a container with its own network namespace, and then he gets an IP address, like 10.10.10.10, for instance. And then you start a second container, and you tell the container to use the same or reuse the namespace of the first container and join the namespaces, basically. And then you have two containers running in different namespaces in terms of processes and mounts and so on, but they share the same namespace in terms of networking, so they can talk to each other over localhost, for instance. So you have like a mail server and a syslog server in two different containers, but they share the same namespace in network terms, so you can lock and you can send mails over localhost, and they can communicate over their own localhost address.
And is that a security breach? But what about mount? Can you also like share the same mount? Yeah, you can.
Yeah, you can. You can. Yeah, this is. I don't think. No, I mean, it's a security breach. I mean, I think you can stage, or you can do. You can, if you are in control, I mean, of the Docker host, can.
The thing was, like, I guess with the virtual VM argumentation was everything is like massively separated. Like, there is no way basically around the hypervisor, but you must have root access to the bare metal and then fiddle around with the hypervisor. Other way, there is no way to get out of your universe and your VM.
So, yeah, but that's not true. There are breaches,
right? I mean, that's the war on the web, and I understand too less of it to actually argue with that. The point I'm having is, argument that you want to have this clean separation, and then for like convenienceness, if we're trying to use the Docker Swarm and we have a lot of containers and we have this network overlay, what we tried last week, it's very luxury to actually have these shared namespaces across multiple machines.
This is not shared namespaces. This networking across multiple machines is just a software-defined network. It's basic Linux networking between the different hosts, so that they have the same network.
I have a misconception here.
Yeah, and the network namespace is just for this process group, so that this process group has its own IP, has its own loopback device, and you can have multiple IPs and multiple devices within the process group, or the container, so to speak. And this you can share. So you can have two containers having the same exact same IP address, the exact same name, host name, the exact same network setups, and so on. So that you just share the network namespace. And this sharing is pretty cool, because you could have your MySQL server, for instance, running in your Elasticsearch, or let's say MySQL server in the container, and to do backups and to do this kind of, or inspections, like monitoring or this kind of stuff. You could have a different container that just starts alongside the MySQL container, shares the namespaces, and then do his backup stuff, and then dies afterwards. So you do not have to put all the tooling of your housekeeping jobs into your MySQL server. You can just have this tooling run in a different container, and then just occasionally starts, and then is destroyed, and so on. And this is a very clean way of doing this kinds of housekeeping jobs. Like backups, you do once a day or so. You start a container, it does a backup in 5 minutes, and then the container dies. And this is a very deterministic outcome. Like, you do not have a container that runs for ages, or you do not have a process that runs for ages and just loops in a for loop until it's time for the next backup. Yeah, the sharing of namespaces, I think it's not utilized yet so much now, but this will be a really cool game change. Because it's clean, right? And you cannot share the pit namespace now. You can say that the container should see all the processes of the complete host, but this is should be more fine-grained, that you can only tell him that he should have the same pit namespace as another container. That would be cool, because then you can do really cool monitoring tricks like accessing pits, looking for a log file, or accessing the stats of a pit or whatnot just by spawning a second container. Okay, this is Linux containers. I think, yeah, we can leave it like that. And how, I think we have no audio.
We have audio, what? Of course we have audio.
Oh, no, it's back.
Ooh, did we just record in the wild?
No, just when I said it's over, and it was over.
It triggered Siri.
Yeah,
shut it triggered down. Siri.
Yeah, okay, so this is...
I think that should be just the first part, actually, because, like, from my perspective, I miss a lot of, like, the underlying ideas and how the kernel works and everything like that. So that's a good thing to know, I hope, most, but, yeah.
Yeah, and we are talking for an hour already.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was actually working, but...
you did listen to me!
I tried to, and as I said, it's very helpful, but I think this should only be, like, the first thing in a series. We should like go back and touch on it ever so often, because like what we did last week has like there was a lot of learnings for me, and what we did with Docker Swarm and how we like also use a whole pipeline of tools that get me from like pushing to a master, then a container, blah blah blah, and then it creates not only a jar but also a container, and then pushes this to the registry, and then I can go to the swarm and I can pull this thing and I can run it, and then I have a different repository where I compose stuff together and launch this in the swarm. And it's still kind of like we have these 3 to 4 places where we need to hit different kinds of stuff, but also I'm able to use a huge cluster of computers to use different kinds of technologies. So it's the not only laptop environment we need to touch again, where we have one Docker Compose file and it's all easy and mostly simple to run everything on your laptop, but still we can manage to get out of our comfort zone with our beefy laptops by just running 10 containers.
So yeah.
That's doubled it with in terms of virtual boxes, but still. And at some point you want to have more compute resources and use them, and then we switch to a different workflow. And I think these are like interesting topics to touch and see how we do this. Not all of them are like open source and can be seen in the wild, but
yeah,
we can definitely talk about it. And that's more interesting for like my developer buddies and not these high performance people, I don't know.
Yeah.
And high note. Sure. How's the planning for your Cray party going on? I was very mean to you yesterday, saying there are not only old people, but how's that going?
The Cray party?
Yeah, give us some insights. I'm a bit like, now I'm a bit jealous, actually. Are you standing besides this huge big Cray box and go, yeah.
No, as I said, next week I will be off to... The International Supercomputing Conference, ISC. And it's like 30 years now, I think, that this ISC is going on in Europe. And they have one sister conference they spawned a couple of years later, like maybe 20 years or so in the US. And then on Tuesday, they start on Monday, and then Tuesday evening, there are vendor parties. And you need an invite. And I have a buddy in Finland. Thanks, Olli. He knows guys, and I have like now both the Intel and the Cray invite to the parties, so I can go and drink.
And would you be so kind and count the people who got an invite? I mean, if it's like 2 or 5, 10 or 30 or
no,
there
I mean,
are
the
really
parties,
like 500
there are
people.
Like 100 people maybe.
Okay.
But the whole conference has
5,000. Okay.
I know it's maybe it's in the hundreds, let's say, maybe 200. I don't
so Buzzword is like roughly 1,000, right?
And I never went to the Cray party, but the Cray party, it's like Fight Club. You do not talk about the Cray party. I think they have the most booze and the coolest location because they have the most of, they have the biggest money.
They have.
They sell a lot of PCs, of HPC systems. They are the big vendor now.
Wow. Yeah, maybe you can hide something in your pocket in your jacket and bring a Cray over.
Yeah. Maybe a Raspberry
yeah.
Pi.
See, I have no understanding of HPC whatsoever.
Yeah, we can do an episode on this as well.
I would go to the Cray party and talk about bare bone PC building my own stuff thingy.
Oh, Java applications.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, cool. So, shall we wrap up?
Yeah, we already wrapped up, right?
So bottom line, Linux containers are just group of processes isolated by different kernel namespaces, and resource restriction comes to three groups. And the cool thing is that you can, if you do not constrain containers, they can use all the horsepower of the thing. So if you have 50 containers running, and only one is using all the resources at one specific point in time, then this is totally cool. So you can have an Elasticsearch cluster, and when the Elasticsearch cluster is busy, the rest hopefully doesn't do much. But if it does, then it's just normal processes on the host. In contrast to virtual machines, where you have to specify the resource beforehand, and if you only give 20% of the resources to this virtual machine, then it cannot use any more than this 20%.
Yeah, and they are still like in a like virtualizing a whole operating system comes to the cost of like there's actually code running beneath you,
yeah.
Which you double. Like
yeah,
you have an
a lot
operating
of...
system, and then you have another operating system, and it's yeah. not the fact that the operating system is not doing anything while your application is running; it's doing a lot. You use two schedulers, for example, which is costly.
Yeah, exactly. And you have this, you have two BIOSes. That's the weirdest thing anyway.
You have more file system caches in between.
Yeah.
So.
But I think nowadays in KVM or KEMU, some of the hypervisors, you can directly start a process instead of going to the BIOS as well and all this initialization of the hardware. So
and they use C groups to do that?
No.
Yeah, the new hypervisor, it's called not Docker. But not Docker, but Docker.
Yeah, okay. So we only talked about the Docker introduction.
I think that's a good thing.
The purpose
was good. I'm very happy with that. Also, I didn't say a million times like.
But the purpose normally was to go through the stuff that I talk about at the conference, and we didn't even touch this.
Yeah, so we make another thing. It's fine. I can do my work, you can talk, and that would be the second one. I'm fine.
Ah, we directly... Yeah, maybe we can do tomorrow one more.
Tomorrow?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I talk for an hour now.
No, let's skip for 1 week and whatever. You will see it in the RSS when we have a new episode. I don't know. We just see what comes.
Okay, guys. Thanks for listening.
Yeah,
for the two Saxonian guys.
Maybe there's also a different person.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.